Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 103 now of the Distraction Pieces podcast. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you very much for tuning in. This week's guest is Tom Rosenthal, and he's fantastic. But I'll tell you right up the front now, because sometimes I have people comment if it's a particularly long intro. This is going to be a long intro, but it's going to be full of good stuff. It's not full of like adverts and stuff like that. It's information and stuff I want to talk to you about. Partly because I've got a lot to catch you up on, and partly because this podcast was a short one. Tom Rosenthal is fantastic. He's in Friday Night Dinner, and he's a great stand-up and wonderful human. And we grabbed a room to chat to him at Channel 4, but we didn't have a lot of time, and the room was booked after us, so it was a bit of a quick let's talk. I mean, we still got 45 minutes. That's still longer than anyone interviewed him that day. He had a load of interviews that morning, and they're all like 2-3 minute ones. But we squeezed this in. But yeah, there's loads of things I want to talk to you about. I made a list. Or first of all, I should mention the reaction to the most recent drunk podcasts. Good Lord. I'm almost ashamed at how well they've gone down, because it's me and four mates just drinking and acting like idiots. And the fourth episode, which I'd said up front, I think has got possibly the best ending of any of the Distraction Pieces podcasts that we've done. But other than that, it is us being drunk idiots. That is now has had the most downloads on day one of any podcast we've done. So yeah, that's weird. I mean, we've had some great people on, and the ones that go down the best are me and my two drunk loser mates. Anyway, it's all good fun. So thank you for enjoying them. But what I need to tell you about is I've done tons of announcements on the book tour. A lot of people know that while I've been doing this podcast, and while I've been doing acting, and while I've been working on a new record, I've been off from touring. And there's parts of it I miss and parts of it I don't miss. But the part I do miss is getting around the country and meeting all you lot. Because anyone who's come to see me live over the 8-9 years of doing 100 plus shows a year will know that I've always run my own merch booth, even when we're at venues. You know, on our last tour, the London was 2,500 cap, and we did two nights in a row there, and goddamn, I stayed on that merch booth until all of you that wanted to come and hang out came and hung out and bought stuff. There's a financial a motive behind it as well. I'm not a saint. It wins for both of us. But so I've got this book coming out, and they asked if I'd do a book tour, and it's a weird one because I'm not doing any gigs or performances until I've got new material. I'm adamant on that. And frankly, because I haven't done any in over a year now, I'm not up to it at the moment. You know, I pride myself on being, this is going to sound arrogant, but good live, or as good as I can be live. And right now, I'm not practiced. I'm not as good as I could be live. So anyway, but regardless of that, I'm not doing any gigs. And I didn't want to just do like a book signing tour, because I ain't Katie Price, you know. And that's not a diss to Katie Price, who'll have people queuing around the block to get her book signed. I'll have a few blokes with beards just turning up to come and get a signature. So I wanted to look into it. So I thought, what I could do, I can't do readings because the book, I've not even mentioned the book, it's the Distraction Pieces podcast book, and this is the first time I'm talking about it with it being finished, and my word, I'm so proud of it. I didn't really realise what we were putting together here, and it's so much better than I could have hoped it would be. And again, that's not an arrogance thing, because the fact is it's better because of all the contributions, because of all the people I talk to. So the way we've done the book, it's not just highlights of the podcast. That's what Amazon describe it as. And it's more than that. It is segments and outtakes from the podcast, but what we've done is chosen topics that come up repeatedly and taken different people's views and opinions on them and put them in sections. So there's a section on race where you'll hear the views and opinions of Akala, of Killer Mike, of Saul Williams, of Riz Ahmed, of some amazing people. In the politics section, you'll hear the opinions of Billy Bragg, of Russell Brand, of Killer Mike, of so many good people. You'll get John Ronson and Amanda Palmer talking about social media in the social media section. So Yeah, it's really exciting. But because of that, I can't really do readings from it. There's also, I'm rambling now, as I tend to do, but there's also extra sections. So I've written an intro to each section. I've written, obviously, an intro to the book. And at the end, I've written a section on how you can become a podcaster, breaking down all the kit that I use, all the platforms I use, and all this kind of thing. So yeah, it's all very exciting. And there's artwork in there from Mr. Heggie, who's, anyone who's aware of Mr. Heggie will be insanely excited about that. But yeah, I thought I can't do a readings because it would just be a weird, a me reading my part and then doing an impression of the person that was a guest. So what I decided was I'd do a tour of mini podcasts. Now, three of them are going to be recorded and they're in bigger venues, in bigger setups. The rest of them are just going to be essentially a live Q&A, but I'll invite you up to sit with me. As we do at the live podcast, you'll come up and you'll ask a question and we'll have a conversation. And then I'll do sign-ins and that as well. So let me quickly read the dates out to you and the locations, because that's not out there too much yet. Yeah, so we're starting on August 3rd on my birthday in London, which I'm going to talk more about in a minute, because that's the really special one. And there's a lot of reasons you might want to attend that. That's at the Leicester Square Theatre. And then we're going to Birmingham on Thursday, the 4th of August. That's at Waterstones. And then we're going to Manchester on Friday, the 5th of August. That's at Waterstones Deansgate. Then Edinburgh on August 6th. That's at the Stand 3. Glasgow on August 8th. That's at the Oran Moor. On August 9th, which is Tuesday, it's Waterstones in Liverpool. On Wednesday, August 10th, it's Rise Records at Bristol. On Thursday, the 11th of August, it's the Waterstones in Brighton. And then on Friday, the 12th of August, we're ending it in Stamford Lee Hope Library, which is mere moments from my house and where I've lived my whole life. My mum has started off working in Stamford Library and has worked in the libraries for 30-odd years, I think. I don't know how long, a long time, let's say. So that's incredibly exciting. All the ticket links and links to pre-order this are in a blog I've done at scroobiuspip.co.uk. So head there and you can get tickets and come along to these shows. I know a few of them have sold out already, but they're small venues. So get in there and have a go. Also in that blog is links to pre-order the book if you can't come to one of the shows. But the London one, I want to tell you a few reasons to come to the London one. And again, make no mistake, I'm aware it's payday in a few days, so this is perfectly placed. But the London one, August 3rd at the Leicester Square Theatre, it's my birthday, and I decided I wanted to spend it with you guys. And we're doing it as I did last time with the Leicester Square Theatre, where it's just I'll get all you guys to make a queue at the side of the stage if you want to come up and ask a question. We'll probably do it in two halves, so there might be a break. But also, something I've noticed and heard is numerous people who've been on the podcast in the past are coming along to that show. I mean, it hadn't occurred to me that partly because it's my birthday as well, so they want to kind of come and hang out. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get some of them up on stage as well. So it's going to be kind of an audience questions and a distraction pieces all stars. But the thing that's exciting about that as well is not only, right, technically the book comes out on August 4th, so we're going to have books at this one. So you're going to be able to buy the book a day early. So number one, you'll be able to be the first people to have the book and have it signed. But number two, none of them have agreed to it. But all I'm saying is if there's some people in the crowd who've been at the podcast, some of them might be in the book, some might not be, but you could probably get them to sign it as well. So you could be the only... So this is kind of the only place that you can get the Distraction Pieces book early, signed by me and signed by numerous other people. So yeah, I'm crazy excited about that. I'm sorry if I've rambled a bit much there, but it's very exciting. I'm just making sure I've said everything I need to say on that. It's all in the blog at scroobiuspip.co.uk. Check that out. Incidentally, I built scroobiuspip.co.uk with Squarespace, who have been one of the long-term sponsors, so a quick shout out to them. Other things I want to talk to you about, upcoming podcasts. I've got a really exciting one coming up that I wanted to pre-hype to you guys. I think we're going to record it as two parts and do one part now and one part in, say, September. But it occurred to me it'd be good to get my mate Tom Coles on the podcast, because Tom has made all of the music videos since Interdiction with me. And the fact is, Interdiction was made for £100 and it's had something like three million views now or something like that. It's had a crazy amount of views. And he's done every video since then with me. And before Interdiction, he'd never... I made a music video. I'd never done one on my own. I'd worked with directors and all sorts of other stuff. So I thought he'd be good to get on. And what we're going to do is we're going to start at Interdiction and then we're going to go through each video and give some insights into how we made it, into, because again, the fact is we've done all of it on this kind of low budget, zero budget nature. And yeah, I think it'd be really interesting and a cool one for the fans of my music and music videos to kind of get that insight, or just people who are into, you know, anything creative in this ever developing digital world that you can do tons of stuff without spending tons of money. The fact is, on the last video we made, it looks like we had this expensive rig for doing these tracking shots and rolling shots. The fact is, we rented a wheelchair for £10 and strapped a load of torches to it and put Tom, the cameraman, in the wheelchair. And then that's how we got it. So there's tons of stuff like that that we've done on all these different videos that we're going to break down and tell you about. So that'll be soon. It's not next week. Next week is the amazing James Acaster, who's one of my favourite comedians. So check that out. other things I want to ramble about to you. I've been talking a lot recently about online about some of my favorite film and TV, and I thought I'll ram a little bit of in here. Number one, this latest series of Peaky Blinders, good lord. The first episode I was like, this is good. Is it starting to rest on its laurels that it's Peaky Blinders, so people just praise it regardless because of the work they've done in the past to earn that? But there was a couple of episodes, man, that I think are some of the best bits of TV I've ever seen. And then straight off the back of that, I finally caught up on The Night Manager, which again, equally just so well written, so well acted, such an amazing ensemble cast. But a one that I posted about online recently was a film called Victoria, which we spoke about in the Izzy Sooty podcast, if you remember, and she'd just been to see it and was saying it was amazing. And I only got round to catching it a few weeks back. And damn, it's so good. And it actually plays into what I was saying about me and Tom, because me and Tom, on the music videos, with Interdiction, with Stunner, with No Whimpers, with numerous ones, we're big fans of the one shot. So getting the whole video in one shot. And this film is a one shot. The whole film is in one shot. But that makes it sound pretentious or poncy. It's not. It's so engaging and amazing. There's a film I saw years ago called Russian Ark, which was famous for being a one shot. And it's all right. It's kind of good. It's impressive. It's a decent film made all the more impressive by the technique it's used. Victoria is a really, really good film made exceptional by the fact they've done it in one shot. If it wasn't in one shot, it'd still be one of my films of the year. The fact that they've managed to pull it off in one shot, and particularly the time in which they do it, so they're going from night to day, it just makes it one of the most impressive films I've ever seen. So I recommend you check that out. I should probably wrap things up ish, shouldn't I? Network stuff. I need to mention just before I go, the network is going crazy. We've had, as you listen to this, we've had a new Tuesday Night Jaw, or several new Tuesday Night Jaws. I'm back on Tuesday Night Jaw in this last one with Jim Smallman. And Tuesday Night Jaw is our wrestling podcast. And it's great. Originally it was going to be a once a month, just a round table, kind of discussing the previous WWE pay-per-view and kind of discussing wrestling in general. And Jim has started doing these extra ones. So it's almost every week and they're fantastic. I can't get enough of them. He did a Raw and SmackDown draft episode, which I can't recommend highly enough. Also, Say Why to Drugs is just going, it's blowing up. I swear it's going to be bigger than Distraction Pieces soon. It's just getting so big so quick. And Say Why to Drugs is a really important podcast. I'm proud of everything that we do on Distraction Pieces, but man, it's an important podcast. It's with Dr. Susie Gage, and it's picking a different recreational drug each week and just giving a breakdown of them, or each episode. It's not every week, it's every few weeks. and just giving a breakdown of them. And it's not pro-drugs, it's not anti-drugs, it's pro-fact and anti-myth. So the three that have been out so far, I think, are marijuana, tobacco, and alcohol. The two more that are already recorded are ketamine and MDMA, but there's more being recorded as we speak. We're going to be covering cocaine, LSD, all these other things. And on these ones at the moment, I'm the guest. So it's Dr. Susie Gage. Again, we wanted it to be effectively someone very informed with an idiot. That's why I was the perfect choice. Or not an idiot, but someone who's not informed, but is curious and open and not biased. So I'm asking the questions, hopefully, that you guys will be wondering if Susie's getting too technical or too over your heads. So yeah, so that's great. And also, we've just launched the new A Leap UK podcast called Stop and Search with Jason Reed. And that's going crazy as well. The first episode was with Robin Ince, podcast royalty, Robin Ince, Dr. Susie Gage, and Simon Oxenham. And they're great. Again, it's in collaboration with Leap UK, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, which is a load of judges and policemen, or ex-judges and ex-policemen and things like that, who are trying to bring our drug laws into modern times, because they've been involved in this war on drugs and they've seen how ludicrous it is and how it's not working. So yeah, they're good. They're worth checking out. All on iTunes and Acast, all on the Distraction Pieces Network. I'm going to shut up now and let you listen to Tom Rosenthal, episode 103 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Well, I've started rolling now. How are you? I'm joined by Tom Rosenthal. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. We're in Channel 4. They've kindly lent us a room, which is lovely of them.
Thank you, Channel 4.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How are you? You rushing around, are busy and stressed, or are you well?
I'm generally very well. I thought today would be a good day to do a podcast sort of discussion.
Yeah.
Because I've just done loads of like press interviews for Friday Night Dinner this morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll be in the mood for talking about stuff deeply. And actually what's happened is I feel like I've just talked myself into a stupor.
Completely.
And now I've got no words. All the words have run out.
I mean, it's a good job that podcasts are such... It's a good job that this isn't a long and unedited podcast. Because that sounds like the worst situation to be in right now. And having not really eaten. You're eating healthy.
Much food. I've got some grapes. I've got some melon. I've got some hula hoops.
That's exciting.
Hula hoops are the loudest one, though. So only going to crack them open is going really well.
Yeah, yeah. A celebratory hula hoop.
Exactly.
You'll know when you're pleased with a particular response, as there'll be a rustling, a cinema rustling. I first became aware of you on Soccer AM.
Yes, indeed.
I realised, and I was watching it. I like Soccer AM. I think it's great. I still think it's great. I think people underrate it a bit because people go, I used to watch it or whatever else. But for not so much comedians, I guess, because there's panel shows and all sorts of other things. But for musicians, it's one of the last shows that you can go on to talk about your new record or new stuff. There's Jules Holland.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, there's not really any music shows, is there? And they are really good at bringing on comedians and all sorts.
Yeah, I was a massive fan of Soccer AM growing up. And I guess in retrospect, you do actually watch it and you realise it. I mean, it's a mainstream show. It's about football and it gets a big audience. But then they do just bring in quite alternative people and quite alternative acts. And
completely.
As long as they can sort of string a sentence together about football. Sometimes they even can't.
Yeah, and exactly. Like when they have Americans on, you know nothing about football. It's just like, just bring them on.
But, when I first got on that, I think it was sort of one of my major aims in life to go on Soccer AM, and I kind of envisioned it in my mind, you know, taking the shot and all that.
Yeah.
And the first time I went on it, it was brilliant. I think people could tell it was just sort of like a dream come true, and I kept going, this is amazing.
I think that's what excited me about it, because it was exactly what I had, and it's why I went down well with the Soccer AM lot, because I was I love this show. I've always wanted to be on, and that excitement of like, I'm talking nonsense, I'm having a laugh.
And I've been on, I did that thing there sort of much maligned comedian in the cupboard thing. Did you ever see that?
That didn't work very well, did it? Well, not specifically for you, but just for people in general.
If I'm honest, I think I actually had an okay time in the cupboard.
Yeah.
Because I had all these, I did a few like flip charts and I had as many pre-prepared jokes as possible. So whereas some people come out of the cupboard and do a minute of stand-up and everyone's like, what's going on?
Yeah.
I just tried to bombard them with as many stupid wordplay puns on player names as I could until people were like, well, there's enough jokes there to sort of enjoy it. And then I went back in my little hole.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure whoever had the idea of putting a comedian in a cupboard. But
no, I mean, to explain for anyone that doesn't know, they had a little section. And that's the beauty of Soccer AM. I remember I was on there once with, can't think of his actual name, but McLovin. From Superman.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he's American, hasn't seen Soccer AM, and we got on really well because I was explaining everything to him. Because there's so much stuff that goes on that you're just like, if you've watched it, you're like, yeah, this is a regular segment. If you've not, you're like, why is there a comedian in a... One of the segments they had was just a comedian in a cupboard, or Tubes. Tubes is a mystery to anyone who hasn't seen... If you're imagine being an American, being on a show and experiencing Tubes for the first time in person... He's just an odd creature, but yeah, the comedian in the cupboard, they basically had an idea where they'd have a comedian in a cupboard and they'd just throw over to him every now and then to just say, I don't know, like, was it topical or to get views and opinion or just,
I'll do some comedy then. That's not really how comedy works, is it? I was unfortunate. No. Well, get the bloke out for a laugh and then got rid of it because it's very difficult
to come
out of a cupboard and be funny.
People just... generally flocked. I remember they had a guy who did a lot of impressions of footballers and managers, and he went down well. But it's like, well, you don't need him in a cupboard. You can just have
the cupboard's impression not the thing here, guys.
What's working here is an impressionist who does football-based impressions.
Good comedy.
It's funny.
Good comedy, but what item of furniture can we cram it into to make it watchable?
It was quite bizarre, but you must have that a lot as a comedian then, because it's one of them jobs that famously, if you're on a night out and you say... what you do to anyone, they're like, come on in, make us laugh, do something funny.
I've been struggling with this my whole career, I suppose, what to answer when...
Yeah.
Because I guess I went for, I do comedy for a bit, but people don't like you.
No.
And then I said... I'm a writer, and then people just assume that you're failing miserably.
Yeah.
And you say you're an actor. You know. And then, so I don't know. It's just, I think I was just going to go, I'm in IT.
I hate the thing of anything like that. And it's similar in my area of entertainment where what I do, I've done all right in. But I'm not super famous or super rich.
So
it's that weird level of if you say, oh, I'm a musician, and they're like, oh, really? They kind of, you have that urge to want to... quantify it, go, well, you know, I've sold out this size, but again, I'm not the kind of person to do that, or I've got a lot of followers on Twitter, but it's like, because you do feel, if you say I'm a writer, they're like, so I've written some stuff that's been made, I'm quite, you know, but no, you're a writer, aren't you?
I just don't know, there's no good way to answer it, really, because the career you've chosen is itself a sort of egoistic career anyway, isn't it? So
truly, and comedian in particular, it's that weird one where I think it was Mitch Hedberg who had a great bit where he was saying, comedian is the only industry where you go, I'm a comedian. I go, all right, do you write? Like, can you write a TV show? Can you act? Yeah. Like, you don't have a guy who's a chef. And I go, you're like, I'm a brilliant chef. He's like, oh, can you farm? Can you produce some food? He's like, no, I'm a chef. It's a weird world where comedian, and I had Stuart Leon, and he was great because he was saying he's realised his goal is... to do what he's doing until he dies.
Yeah.
There's not this, I'm a stand-up, and then I hope to do this, or I hope to do that. He's got to that point where he's like, no, this is what I do. This is it. But it's a weird world.
To reach that point, wouldn't it?
But you get to... You've kind of had success in all areas, in your acting, in your stand-up, in your writing and everything. Let's kind of go back with the two things that we've touched upon. Soccer AM and a football and comedy, and they must have had huge parts in your upbringing, being that your dad is famous football commentator and commenter Jim Rosenthal.
I mean, I got indoctrinated into sport pretty young,
and
I guess I'm ultimately very, very thankful for that, because it gives me an incredible amount of joy and satisfaction.
Yeah,
And it is on that sort of... I always empathise with religious people because personally I'm sort of agnostic, but I kind of go, I get it.
Yeah.
I get why you're so into this, because generally when you were like one or two, someone around you was really, really into it.
Yeah.
And made you think that it was the most important thing. And so now,
comparison, yeah, with,
now
with,
I'm really, really into it. And I realise it's irrational and it's nonsense and it's men running around in silk kicking balls into nets and it means nothing. But when you're in a big environment surrounded by lots of other people who feel the same way and have an involvement in a completely irrational thing occurring, it's so wonderful to be a part of and it's so beautiful. And it's as close as I ever feel to society as a whole is when, you know, talking about football, like the... I don't know, it's a bit base thing to bring it back to, but my tweets that get the biggest retweets will be a wry observation about a football game that's going on, because it's got the most people who are involved in it. And so...
And hugely and passionately involved. And that's what I think people who don't watch football don't understand, is it's a beautiful way, particularly, again, in a society where, particularly in football for many years, men are men.
Yeah.
It's a manly thing. Football is somewhere where you're allowed to experience emotions, mm-hmm. like true extremes of emotions. I remember Millwall in the playoff final at Wembley when we scored against Scunthorpe, and it was an amazing goal, one of the best goals at Wembley ever. The emotion I felt then, it genuinely flashed through my mind. That I was like, I don't think I ever want to get married or have a child, because I don't want to knock this moment off the top of my happiest, most elated moments. And we ended up losing, and the sadness experience then, and the genuine emotion then. But then you can go back to life after that. I don't know, I think it's a positive thing there to have somewhere where you can experience these highs and lows of emotion,
mm-hmm.
but it is still, as you said, it's still just a game.
Yeah.
It's still just a silly thing. I'm not going to be in tears for weeks. Or for example, the season before last, when Millwall got relegated, I was okay with that.
Yeah.
And when we got to the playoff final this year, we didn't quite have it in us. Cool. I'm still going to be a fan next season. Still going to keep going on.
It's weird. I mean, I don't want to get too deep too quickly, but
you're welcome.
It is like life.
Yeah.
In that it's meaningless.
Yeah.
And it's irrational. And it's unfair, and you have searing highs and searing lows, and what you get out of it is how you react to those things.
Yeah.
So you seem to have found the ideal position, which I hope I also have, where you can, you know, really feel the joy of the amazing goal, but you don't let the relegation ruin your life.
Yeah.
And that is just like living a life.
I was going to say, I think that's being a Millwall fan. You get used to a lot of lows.
I'm an Arsenal fan, and you just reassess. It's exactly like life as well. It's like where you are in the standings, you get very, very unhappy, very rich people. And you get very, very happy, very poor people.
Yeah.
Where you are in the standings doesn't matter. It's how you react to the ups and lows within that journey that defines how much joy you get out of your life. The football is good. And it's just, I know it's tempting for people who aren't into sport to dismiss it as nonsense, but in the same way that I hope I'm empathetic towards people who are religious, despite the fact that I'm not, I just wish sometimes that they could show a little bit more empathy to people who are into sport, because it's not moronic.
It is
life, you know, and it's a way to tap into the fundamental things of being a human being.
It's the misperceptions and misconceptions and the stuff that's highlighted, and not to keep harping on about Millwall, but Millwall are a prime example of that. Is we'll have seasons of really good stuff, and then as soon as we have some crowd trouble again, because of our history, it'll be a typical Millwall. Do you know what I mean? That's all the people who don't support Millwall are going to notice, just the bad stuff. They won't notice that a couple of seasons ago we didn't have a sponsor and we gave our sponsorship over to a testicular cancer charity, because Neil Harris, our all-time top goal scorer, defeated testicular cancer. It's one of the most emotional moments in the club's history of my era, and things like that. And the fact that we're one of the first to achieve the highest level in the kick racism out of football thing. And again, I would be the first to say we were one of the first to achieve the highest level because we were one of the ones that needed it the most. We had a big history of racism and problems. It's like, I'm happy to admit that, but it's that thing. And only reason I mention it is it's going to be similar now. I've already heard on a few American podcasts who I've never heard talk about football. As soon as there's been a trouble with England and Russia in Europe, there have been football hooligans, all this kind of thing. It's like, it is
it is, it should be looked down upon, it should be discussed, it should be shamed, but football is a massive thing week in, week out in England, and we don't have hooligans and trouble every week at every game. So it's a shame when people outside of it just suddenly go, see, they're just animals. They're animals. I mean, you look at us too. When you wouldn't look at us and
well,
go,
a bit for yourself,
diehard
mate.
Football fans. You're kind of.
I got a swastika tattoo on.
Oh, we're both skinny and white, and not intimidating looking.
I reckon we shave our heads. We can get by.
We'd get away with it, I'm sure. But yeah, it's an interesting one. It's that outside look that
it's hard because obviously on public transport, all you see is, you know, slightly intimidatory, yobbish chanting, and it's not nice. So you can't advocate that, but it's an expression of community and society which I don't get from anything else.
Yeah,
and I'm until my death, I'll be a vehement defender of professionalised sport.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, you've touched a couple of times on about not being a religious, and it's a weird thing. It sounds strange to compare it to the female comedian debate right. Or female comic is for some reason if you're female, it gets listed and put at the front, but. As a Jewish comedian,
right?
It's something I've read many times and in many places. But you're not, you don't particularly have any jokes about Jewish stuff.
No,
you're not a religious person. So, how's that as a kind of odd one? Because it's something I guess you kind of, in many ways, you have to embrace because it's like you're not ashamed in any way or against.
It's so. It's really confusing. I don't identify as Jewish. I mean, I would say I'm not Jewish, right? But I got a Jewish face and a Jewish name. My nose is, you know, more Jewish than Alan Sugar freeing a pig or whatever. Yeah, you know, you don't get much more Jewish than my nose. So I've got Jewish blood on my dad's side, right? Yeah. But they haven't been practicing Jews for like three generations. My mum is completely English, like completely whatever you go, Gentile. And it's a maternal system. So if your mum's a Jew, you're a Jew, right?
Right.
It doesn't really matter what your dad is. So I'm not Jewish in any way, apart from in the eyes of the media, who I've just done these Friday night dinner questions and they go, oh, you're the only Jewish member of the cast. It's not that I want to reject being a Jew or Jewish. I'm in a Jewish show, Friday Night Dinner, which I guess doesn't help in terms of my perception as a Jewish person. But all the other cast members are in a Jewish show and they're never seen as Jewish.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult because I don't want to reject this. I don't want to be, I'm not a Jew because I love the fact that I've been welcomed in and Jews are kind of known for claiming people in the public eye as one of their own, even if there's a debate.
But
my dad
way.
Would be in a way that they want to embrace. And my dad was always a bit more conscious of it, I think, because he grew up in a time where there was, you know, more, I don't know what you call it, persecution. Like he got bullied for being a Jew in a way that I never did.
Yeah.
And he gave me a middle name, Smith, which is my mum's maiden name, which if ever wanted to de-Jewify myself and call myself Tom Smith, I could do. I didn't do that because I think Tom Smith sounds like a very bland man.
Yeah,
like, I wouldn't want to go and listen to Tom Smith talk. He sounds like he makes ales or something.
It's not that appealing,
I love the name Rosenthal. It means Valley of Roses in German, and it's a German Jewish name, which is why I live here because they left.
Understandable.
So. It's a bit complex.
Understandable is an understatement. There isn't understandable.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So whether you know, and I try and talk about this a little bit in my comedy, but it's so convoluted. Like just try and be funny, and I definitely also do exhibit the classic tropes or whatever you would associate with Jewish comedy. I.e., I speak first, and I'm quite nerdy, and I'm quite anxious.
Yeah.
And people are just looking at me going, how are you not Jewish? You know,
classic Jews.
There's a Jewish sense of humour. Like, what other... Yeah. You know, there's a Hindu sense of humour. Do you know what I mean? What is that?
I remember early on, I got an awful lot of claiming from many different... religions and heritage when we blew up. And I remember getting hit up by a magazine, I'm sure it was in Manchester, called J-Life. And again...
J-Life, yeah.
I'm up for press. Press is good. And they hit me up saying, we'd like to talk to you, like, we'd like to interview you. I was like, all right, that sounds good. It's like, yeah, we want to discuss your experiences as a Jewish performer. And I was like, right, I'm not, and I've not even got the history of my family. I've got the beard and a bit of a nose too.
And I was like, well, and the beauty of their response.
I love the idea of someone just going through pictures of people going, has he got, is that, yeah, there we go.
Not doing any more research than that. Not doing any more research. Just getting in touch. You'll do. But the thing I loved about the warmth of their response, because I wrote back going, I'd love to do an interview, but I need to let you know I'm not Jewish.
Yeah.
And they hit back saying, oh, that's all good. Well, we'll leave it. And then just said, do you know any Jews?
Do you know any Jews?
They're asking me to recommend others. Like, who can I pass them on to?
No.
So he's good. I recommended DJ Yoda in the end. Incidentally, I was like, I do know a Jew. Thank you. Here's one.
I've had the same sort of thing with people ring me up from the Jewish Chronicle, and I do the same thing. You know, go, I'm not actually Jewish, and they just go, well, you are. You know, yeah it's fine. Yeah,
you can believe what you want.
Precisely. Yeah, you can think you're not, but you definitely are. And so,
good.
Well, no, I mean, it's as you say, it's fine. I don't mind being any group that wants me is fine. Get me involved.
It's one of them weird warmths with it. It's not one I've ever felt weird about. When different, and again, I'll have it. In parts of London, I'll get, because of having a beard, kind of before beards got so popular, really, because I've had a beard a long time, I would get really nice warm nods and mumblings under the breath from people of all different religions, and I'd feel like I wanted to confess to them and say, I'm sorry, I don't deserve that warmth. I'm not part of this particular group or gang kind of thing. So it's like, I felt awful for it. We've talked about a football growing up. What was comedy's influence on your upbringing? How early were you into comedy? Were you always a make 'em laugh kid, or what?
I don't know what I was like as a kid. I think I was probably quite annoying and precocious and attention seeking. I arranged a World Cup for, I think it was like my ninth birthday, at the Magnet Leisure Centre in Maidenhead, and I picked all the teams and I did all the group stages and the whole tournament tree, and my team didn't get through the groups, so I just cancelled it. I just had a massive strop, and I walked out to the little restaurant where my cake was, and I was like, "No, tournament's over." And because it was my birthday, they had to give the tournament up. That gives you an insight into the kind of mind. It was,
but again, it's that kind of thing. It's right. Well, we need him to focus on something, or he's going to be a horrible tyrant or dictator.
Yeah. I mean, I was an only child, and I spent a lot of time on myself. And I guess I thought that the world should revolve around me, and so I kind of tried to make a career where that is in some way the case.
Yeah. So when did you step into comedy?
I remember seeing Lee Evans at the Wembley Arena, and my dad taught me when I was about 15. I think you had to be 18 to get in.
Yeah.
And that in itself was quite a subversive act, I suppose. But I remember just watching him and thinking he was absolutely amazing.
People forget how huge he was for a minute. It was only a few years, it seems like, but when I was growing up, it was the same. And weirdly, he used to exercise in the park that was on my walk to school. So we'd walk past and see
him in the park.
Sweating, as he does, but due to exercise rather than stage. But he was huge, wasn't he? And one of the first to re-come, like, I think comedy had died, it felt like it died down, or stand-up at least had died down a little bit.
Yeah.
He was one of the first that seemed to come back and go, no, this is a mainstream thing.
Well, I wasn't a particularly cool kid or knowledgeable kid about culture or anything. Yeah. I mean, I just watched the Paramount Comedy Channel too late, you know, after my parents had gone to bed, and I was waiting for some softcore pornography.
Yeah.
And I managed to see shows like Spaced and Big Train at those times. So I was hit by the mainstream love of someone like Lee Evans, and I just so captivated by his ability to perform. And then, TV, slightly weirder TV shows. And my friend at school also gave me Jam, Chris Morris's sketch show.
Jam was great. And the radio show originally, it came from.
I listened to
just
that.
So weird and odd.
And that has one of my favourite things in it ever was like Mark Heap being Mr. Lizard.
Yeah. It's my favourite. I've got my club night, We Are Lizards. And
is that called because of that?
For ages, I'd post videos of that, because when he's going, Miss, and he's going to call his boss. He's like, I want to talk to your boss. Yeah. What's your boss like?
So
another Mr. Lizard. It's such a weird sketch, but it's so
weird, but for some reason, I just find it one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I completely agree.
And
Mr. Lizard.
Comedy. I don't know how into it I was, really. I just liked this stuff, and I bumbled along at school, did a did like some house drama. I did the ones where we used to write our own plays and perform. Right. I went to a sort of semi-posh school. We did public speaking as well.
Yeah.
I did public speaking competitions where we'd go like around the world sometimes. Went to like Canada and Cyprus. Oh, wow. And compete against all these like posh schools. Who,
speaking about what though? Like,
well, there's like, there was, it's, it also satisfied my sort of... like for tournament-based activity, because there was like 9 different categories, and you would do like 4. So I think the ones I did was like newscast, where you had to get like a newspaper and in like 4 minutes write 20 minutes write a newscast that was a 4-minute appraisal of the news.
Brilliant.
In the guise of a certain radio station. So it could be like Jazz FM, or I mean, it was weird.
Wow.
And then we did an impromptu one where you'd get a title and you'd have 2 minutes to write a 5-minute speech. And the ones that I was really good at were just called after dinner speeches, which were basically take a topic and you just be funny about it, which is essentially stand up for posh little kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we do like readings, and it was a really peculiar thing to take part in.
So bizarre, because comedians and footballers tend to end their career with after dinner speeches. It's bizarre that you started your career with after dinner speaking.
It's quite
weird.
Let's
see where they all kind of end up. Let's start with that.
Yeah, so I'm going to end as a really promising young comedian. It's about the planet, like Benjamin Button.
Yeah. That's bizarre. I love that. But so how did you find your way into stand-up?
I think basically I was at school and like people told me I could do it, and I did with house public speaking where you do it around the whole school, and I won quite a lot of the, you know, just being funny. And so I got a kind of sense of people laughing and that it was something I could kind of do. And also I had this only child upbringing, like I was somehow important and should be listened to.
Yeah.
And I left school and there was no outlet for it. And so
that's because TED Talks hadn't been invented, which is the platform for anyone who thinks they've got. I've got a real bugbear with TED Talks. I've turned down TED Talks 4 times now,
right?
Because I've got nothing to say. Like, I don't feel I've got anything I need to do a speech on. Whereas when TED Talks started, it was this impressive thing of these really amazing, powerful things. And now there's just so many.
People
need to know my view on. This, it's like, nah, just put it in a tweet, mate. It's not a TED Talk. It's
tweet talk.
That's a tweet. I watched your TED Talk. My conclusion is that was a tweet. That was maybe a double tweet. But other than that, maybe a Facebook status. But
what would you do a TED Talk on if you had to do?
I genuinely wouldn't know what to say. The only thing that's occurred to me recently is exactly this. The overuse of TED Talks and
that would be good.
Just because I genuinely think it's a weird subversive thing. And there was a time when I was growing up, and you will have seen it too, that someone like Katie Price would have a book out in her 20s, a biography, and everyone would go, she's only 20, how can you have a biography? Do you know what I mean? It was seen initially as a shock that someone would have the audacity to think that their life is worth putting into a biography at such a young age. Whereas where social media has come through, and we've all become far more comfortable with the fact that the minute details of our day are worth documenting and sharing, like I'm in this building, or I'm just on my lunch break having a read. These things, in my opinion, this goes out, aren't important. I love my mum. I don't give a fuck what she's doing at this moment because she's at work, she's doing stuff. I don't need a Facebook update to let me know what she's doing. I'll catch up with her in a week or at the weekend. And we'll talk about the important things rather than every detail. And I think that thing in social media has given us this weird belief that, again, all of us have something of great importance to say.
Right.
And it's weird from someone who's got a 90-minute or hour 90-minute podcast every week to say, no, you haven't. But, do you know what I mean? I feel the excitement of the podcast is the guests and what they've got to say. But I don't know. If I was to do a TED Talk, it'd be on exactly that of the overexposure of TED Talks and the potential that we haven't got anything to
receptive
say.
The audience
they
would
probably
be.
Won't be asking me again. I probably won't get another invite. I wonder if I'd present it as something else and then when I get there just be a maverick.
By
have slides prepared
that you're
could,
all dickheads.
It could be read either way.
Yeah,
so it's going to be one thing, honestly.
I like it
anyway. So yeah, it was kind of a public speaking thing that got you into it, because one of the things when doing some research I noticed, which was quite unusual, was you won a lot of awards as best student comedian, which I thought was quite an unusual. I'd never really known of that as this big, important category, but you seem to blow up as a student a comedian. How was that? So that must have been coming kind of soon off of the back of that, right? It must have been soon after that.
So I spent 3 years at university, and again, I just love tournaments. Yeah. Like, I just love it. The Euros are going on at the moment. I had a World Cup for my birthday. Student comedy competitions are just tournaments. They were like little, they were, you know, legs and semi-finals and then a final. And for some reason, that really tapped into my way of approaching comedy. I really wanted to win the competitions.
Yeah.
And it's not the most artistic or venerable reason to get into the art of self-expression. However, it made me get good, and it gave me a platform by which I could measure my progress. I've never been a comedian who gigs as much as he should. You know, I'm not one of these who do two or three gigs in the night. I've always liked the way of organising my performances as measurable goals. So Edinburgh's perfect because I can work really, really hard, and I know I've done a show and the show will be finished at that point. For some reason, I'm goal orientated in a way that I'm not very good at just constantly doing it and getting slowly better. So the competitions were perfect for me because they were like a real aim, and I knew that I had to hone a 7-minute set for that day, and then I would really prepare for it. I'd warm up for it like the players would warm up for the Euros with, you know, three rubbish fixtures that don't mean as much. And I don't know, it just suited my approach. So the reason I did well in those competitions is because I think I had a much more competitive approach than other comedians who were probably doing it in a better way, where they were just treating them as gigs
and
just trying to enjoy themselves.
And there's two really interesting things there I want to pick up on. Number one is the tournament setup is a different art form in many ways.
Completely.
It's the same with spoken word or freestyle rap cunning, where you can win a rap battle as not the best rapper. You just have the best punchlines and those best moments that the crassest thing. So a comedian could get up in his 7 minutes and do one amazing 7-minute build that gets to this point that's artistic and beautiful, and the next comedian could get up and have a punchline every 30 seconds and steal the show completely. Now, it's two different art forms, and
I mean, comedy shouldn't be a competition. You know, I've since learnt this.
Yeah,
it's silly that we have comedy competitions, but they're great for the industry, and they're great for people who are making their way in the industry just to go, to make a bit of an impact.
And it's cutthroat. You know, it's very much you're living and dying off in that moment. That didn't work. No, you've lost.
Yeah.
It's not. Oh, that was all right. I think they enjoyed it. It's just not that laugh out loud stuff.
I mean, you know, the fine of one of these competitions is where the person saw me who put me up for the audition for Friday Night Dinner. And it's scary to think of it. And that's what's going through your mind before you do these competitions. But it's what happens.
Yeah, completely.
People do well in that and they'll get signed and then they'll become, you know, whatever, Rob Beckett or Joe Lycett or these people who I've been in competitions with who've been picked and then they've gone really well. I'm sort of, I feel obviously beyond that kind of method of approaching it now, because I feel like I'm getting into the part of my career where I want to just be a good artist and do good shows as opposed to trying to prove myself. But it's weird, especially the drive at the start of your career to prove yourself is so all-encompassing.
And then
I feel like I've maybe got there a little bit before my time because I've had this TV success, and so now I feel like I've proved myself before I've kind of got the skills to do so. I've not quite caught up. I don't think the shows that I make are going to be good enough to actually necessarily match up to the amount that I've proved myself now, if you see what I'm saying.
Right, I get it. It's interesting, and hearing your view on Edinburgh was another thing that fascinated me, because I got that from your show. I came to see your show, and I regretted it, because I came to see it before my first Edinburgh show. I saw your show and Britt Goldstein's show,
and both of you
just had these complete shows. And Edinburgh's an interesting thing. A lot of comedians will go up with half an idea and develop it over that month because you're doing it every night. But it felt that you two had turned up with, here's the show I'm going to be doing, almost word for word for the next 30 nights. And that scared the life out of me, because mine, although I'd crafted it, it felt like I had, it felt more of a gig than a show. And again, I honed it, and I went home that very night, which was the night before my first one, and tightened up the segments in between each spoken word piece and things like that, to turn it into here's what it's going to be, rather than talking this gap about this and then do this poem. It's like, no.
But I mean, tighten this. Your show was better. I mean, and it was better for numerous reasons. But I think one of them is that, you know, the way I approach performing live is not the way that the best shows are made. It should be a live experience. And almost what I try to do is take out the live element by essentially doing it like an actor. You know?
I like that. And I think, again, there's different places to all of it. And it's a weird comparison now, but one of the best live bands I've ever seen was a Young Fathers. And I saw them supporting Run the Jewels. And they were amazing because in my gigs, I've always had a lot of crowd interaction, a lot of banter, a lot of freedom. They did their gig as if they were in a practice room, but going really hard. It's like they didn't acknowledge the crowd once, but it was such a polished and perfect thing. And it's what I kind of felt with your show. Not that you didn't acknowledge the crowd, but it felt that you could have done that full hour in an empty room. Yeah. If you needed to.
No, that's completely true, and I do that.
Whereas there's a lot of shows that if they did it in an empty room, it'd be 30 minutes or 45 minutes, but they need that crowd for bouncing back and forth and all these things.
Yeah, so. there's a difference when, you know, in between using crowd as filler, but also just the fact that the crowd is there, that's the moments often that people remember as the best bit. That you need the material, but it's when something unique happens in the room, in that moment, as a live event that won't have happened to any other crowd. And I'm not good at achieving that because I'm scared of it. I don't like it. You know, I like doing my bit. And that's something that I have to get over, I think, really. You have to kind of have more faith in yourself as a performer and as someone who is kind of funny to you know, give yourself over to the live experience, basically. Yeah. So I hope that will come with experience.
It's exciting. I want to talk about what's to come, but we are in this room for a limited amount of time, so I want to make sure. We'll keep going, but I just want to make sure we get in now a Friday night dinner, because again, it was having seen you on Soccer AM and having seen a bit of your stand up, it was the first thing I saw you acting in, and it was a big deal. That show, it was the first thing Simon Bird had done after The Inbetweeners, I believe. So there was and The Inbetweeners had been a huge thing for Channel 4, and it was very different from that. And from the first episode, for me, it just hit the target completely. It sounds like a sick a fanatic thing to say. It was so Channel 4 because it was just this unique and odd thing. And yeah, so how did it come about, and how is it to work on? And
yeah, this is what I've been sort of talking about all morning, but it doesn't make it any less true.
Switching to morning mode now.
Is the idea that the guy who writes it, Robert, is a very weird man. I don't know whether you ever saw Look Around You. With Peter Serafinovich
and James Serafinovich as well.
He's mad. But he wanted to make a show that people, you know, that's for the mainstream audience, basically. So Friday Night Dinner is a family sitcom, but it is quite uniquely weird in that it kind of taps into the strange idiosyncrasies that his family in particular have. But the fact that his family has idiosyncrasies is kind of applicable to all families.
Yeah.
So once people have tuned in to the weird lexicon and the weird relationships that the Goodman family have, they kind of see their own family in it, even if they're doing very, very different stuff. So it kind of, as you say, it's a perfect show for Channel 4 in that it marries, you know, weird, like quite cool, odd comedy with just a family sitcom.
That's what struck me as strange, because like, when you've got characters like the dad, who's just so odd, and there's so much weird, and the neighbour and all sorts of stuff, there's so much weird stuff going on, yet somehow you do watch it and it's incredibly relatable. Like, it shouldn't be relatable. You should go, well, these are obviously ludicrous characters.
It doesn't seem that weird, does it? Ridiculous, when you're watching
this feels just like family,
And I think that's kind of why it's done as well as it has, really. Because it doesn't feel bland, but it doesn't feel mental either.
The competition between, the natural feeling competition between you and Simon as brothers, again, it's just so real and relatable. And hearing your general love of competition,
he's the same.
He's more clear now, but it's just
we're constantly playing ridiculous, like silly games on set. Yeah. We just roll a ball of tape up and play, you know, tape golf or tape tennis, tape basketball. I mean, genuinely, we just spend all of our time doing that, and we break stuff regularly. We just break stuff, and someone else has to go and clear it up, and we apologise, and then we just keep playing.
So how's it been though that it's been this success? Because again, it is particularly I mean, I'd say particularly with Channel 4, is they take a lot of risks, but that means a lot of stuff ends up by the wayside. I was raving recently about Aliens, which was on Channel 4, and that's just, I've just found out it's not getting a second series. I thought that was amazing. I thought it was one of the best things I've seen in ages. So, but again, it was a risky thing, and the fact is, if the viewing figures aren't there, that's the world we live in. So it's this real weird area. So how was it to be aware that you were taking, or what was the point where it felt, right, this is work? Because initially you think, oh, I've got the gig, I'm in it, this is great. But then there's still that risk of, is it going to be shit? And then you make it, and it's good, but is anyone going to care? And then people care, and it gets a second series. Right. Is there a point where you go, right, this is cool now?
I feel like before this series is when that happened. Yeah. I mean, for some reason, everyone just seemed so much more relaxed, and everyone knew exactly what they were doing, and the interactions between the characters, and it felt like a lot of the neurosis, obviously there's always lots of neurosis, but a lot of it had gone. I mean, for the first series, for me, because also in the rehearsal period, so there was a taster take, right?
Yeah.
Taster take, which given to E4, which is just like a little 15-minute clip of what the show could be like, which I auditioned for, didn't get in.
Oh, wow. Right?
And then they were like, we'll have a pilot, but we're going to look at that role again. So then I auditioned for that, and then I got in the pilot.
Yeah.
Right. And then we're making the pilot, someone else got booted out. Right. So for the first series, I just constantly think I was going to get booted out. It's only about 4 weeks in that I was like, well, they've now filmed so much that to get rid of me would be such a financial burden on them that they're just going to keep me now. And so it was, making it was constant neurosis. And then obviously when it comes out, it's quite exciting to be in a TV show, but it's the same thing. Everyone, you know, Britain wants everything to fail, don't they? And then it got a very good audience, and the second one went down quite well, but it was on a Sunday night, so it kind of affected audiences because of where it was placed rather than the show itself.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a sort of really boring, long-winded way around, but essentially there's neuroses at every point, as you say, and until this series, where I feel like now it actually is in the sort of, it's in the national psyche of, you know, comedy fans. Comedy people know about it and like it. Well, not everyone likes it, but, you know.
The fact is now, and the nature of how intake of TV has gone, the fact is now you've got a back catalogue, and people can binge if they want to, and do you know what I mean? You can go back on 4OD and these kind of things, and get through stuff.
It's really nice.
And jump into stuff that really, it's what I knew when I started podcasts. I was surprised at the success we had early on, because in my mind I was like, you need a back catalogue, because people need to be able to go, I like that, I'll download this 10. Do you know what I mean? You can't just go, here's my podcast, there'll be another one in a week, because the nature of podcasts is you consume and consume and consume, and it's similar with this. So to take a TV show to that point, it must be now, right, as you said, now we can relax and make it what it needs to be, rather than panicking about everything.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it.
No,
I mean, it's everyone else's talent and skill that has taken it to this point. I've got absolutely no idea how to make a show as sort of successful as Friday Night Dinner has been, but the channel have really supported it. I think they supported it a lot because, as you said, Simon and Tamsin were in it, who have already been in big successes on the channel. So their faces and Mark Keep, mainly Tamsin and Simon, because they're faces that are already attached to big successful mainstream shows. So if there was a slight wobble in audience or a slight wobble in reaction somewhere, the channel were always behind it.
That's great. That's handy.
And the show as well, I think, does quite consistently deliver in terms of episodes. Yeah. There's not too many failures or dud episodes that people are watching go, this is really bad. But it's just to do with people working very, very hard and me benefiting from it. Not really working that hard.
It's what's great is Channel 4 will take these risks, not to talk about stuff that is nothing to do with you, but Chewing Gum recently was another one.
I love
that's
that show. Yeah,
cleaning
yeah,
up, and it was just fantastic. It's so odd. I saw it winning a lot of awards. I was like, oh, "What is this?" And I watched all of them. Yeah. I think on 4OD in like in 2 days, and was like, "I've never seen a show like it." But it's something that, again, 5-10 years ago, it might not have been able to take a risk on it, but because of the on-demand nature of stuff, the fact that you can just catch it when you want.
Because they were filming Aliens when we were filming Plebs.
Yeah.
And so I hung out with Michael Socco and Michaela Cole. I spent the whole last night. I was there with her, which I did, but it wasn't. Anyway. Yeah. And she's just an amazing human being.
And she's going to be huge. She's like
the. you know, the reasons, like I was saying, that I got into comedy to like win competitions and stuff. She is the complete polar opposite of someone who just needs to tell stories and wants to improve other people's lives with her stories. And she's very, very inspirational human being, and I look forward to seeing what else she makes.
That's perfect. We've got people
getting shunted out lingering,
so we're gonna tidy up and empty the room. No, it's fine. Also, do want to give a quick shout out, as you mentioned, to Plebs there, because I love that as well. And Tom Davis was on the podcast, and we raved about it there.
To him talk about that, it was fantastic. Nice.
But thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks. I'm really sorry about curtailing it like this. It's quite
what are the PR details you're meant to say about Saturday night or Friday night dinner?
That's out in 6 weeks or whatever. I don't know when this podcast goes up. It'll probably be
in 2 weeks, so it's a month away.
Friday night dinner, Channel 4 coming up. That's it.
And where can people keep up with your stuff?
I'm at RosenTweets on the Twitter.
At RosenTweets, there he is.
You know, just say hello if you want. Thanks for listening.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 103, with the one and only Mr. Tom Rosenthal. Absolutely loved having him on. He's a lovely guy. It's a shame it had to be a bit rushed. It's not his fault. It's not my fault. It's just the lay of the land and the way of the world there. Thank you very much for tuning in. Please subscribe, etc., etc. I will also mention at the end here the blog. I know I did a long intro and you'll forget a lot of it, but the main thing is the blog at scroobiuspip.co.uk. Please come along to some of these shows, particularly the London one on my birthday. Come and share my birthday with me. Yeah, that's all I want to say. I'll see you next week when we've got James Acaster. See you in a bit.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.